From the heart of our nation's capital, here's Family Research Council President Tony Perkins. Sitting in today for Tony is our own Sarah Perry, Director of Partnerships for Family Research Council.
Welcome to this Friday edition of Washington Watch. I am indeed Sarah Perry, your Director of Partnerships here, sitting in for Tony Perkins this afternoon. Well, last night, we were witness to yet another Democratic presidential debate. This time, the top 10 candidates greeted, or rather eviscerated, one another in Houston, Texas. And in just a minute, I'll share my thoughts and Republican Congressman Andy Biggs's thoughts with you as I share some sound bites from the debates. In my second segment, the New York City Council made the surprising move to repeal their ban on sexual orientation therapy. I'll talk with Roger Brooks, senior counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom, on their change of tune. At the bottom of the hour, Facebook labeled two videos from the pro-life group Live Action as false news and censored the videos. Both videos stated that abortion was not medically necessary. And I'll talk with Dr. Ingrid Skop, an obstetrician and gynecologist in practice for 22 years, who defended the Live Action videos and will set the facts straight on what's medically necessary and what isn't. And at 42 past the hour, I will talk with Max Eden, co-author of Why Meadow Died, The People and Policies That Created the Parkland Shooter and Endanger America's Students. Max will be speaking Tuesday here at Family Research Council as part of our speaker series on the 17th, in which C-SPAN is set to cover. You can go to our website, frc.org/events, for more information on the lecture and to register to attend. As a reminder, go to tonyperkins.com, which is the website for today's messaging and podcast. Follow Tony on Twitter at tperkins, or me, if you'd like, at Sarah P. Perry. Well, last night, the top 10 Democratic presidential contenders that are polling highest debated each other in Houston, Texas. And I'll share some sound bites and get analysis from my next guest. He is the 5th District of Arizona Congressional Representative Andy Biggs and serves on the House Judiciary Committee as well as the Science, Space, and Technology Committee. Congressman Biggs, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Hey, Sarah, it's good to be with you.
So before we talk about last night's Democratic presidential debate, first, I would, as would our organization here, like to congratulate you on your selection as the new chairman for the House Freedom Caucus. And for those of our listeners who aren't familiar with the Freedom Caucus, can you describe a little bit about its mission and purpose?
Yeah, sure. So the Freedom Caucus was formed a number of years ago to try to combat what I call the uniparty, but others call it the establishment. President Trump calls it the swamp. And what it is people who are not letting the voices be heard of the average American. America is still a conservative, a center-right country, and a lot of times people get to D.C. and forget. So they started it with nine original members. It's grown significantly since then. Jim Jordan was the first chairman, and then Mark Meadows, and I'm the third. But our purpose and function is to, quite frankly, act as a conservative voice in the Congress, and quite frankly, to make sure that we try to at least enforce a memory of the conservative promises that have been made to the American people.
And really it is, as your office has stated, they issued a press release, one that you came out with as soon as your election was made known. This is such an important caucus because this is principle over politics. This is really standing for the foundational notions upon which the country was founded. And in so doing, it really does represent the heartbeat of our nation, the principles upon which we still rely. So I want to turn now, make a switch, and talk a little bit about last night's Democratic debate. And we're at no shortage for thoughts, I'm sure, but they really did sort of made their perspectives on some of these left-wing issues, a little slightly more left of center with every consecutive debate, but it's clear from the outset that they were all gunning for President Trump. So let's listen to an oversight clip right now. Number one.
There's enormous, enormous opportunities once we get rid of Donald Trump.
He is treating our farmers and our workers like poker chips in one of his bankrupt casinos.
We must and will defeat Trump, the most dangerous president in the history of this country.
So no real surprises. But Congressman Biggs, what was your overall impression of the debate? And do you think they are reaching everyday Americans or just spewing left wing base talking points? What's your impression?
I really believe, Sarah, that they have gone so far out to the left that they're leaving what I would say is their normal, the old time Democrats that I used to know. I think they're leaving them in the dust. These people are so radicalized. They've become, I like to tell folks, they've become Europeanized. They want us to look like a defunct Europe, a post-religious, post-freedom Europe. And that's what you have in Europe going on today a little bit. And that's where they would like us to be. And I say, I don't think they're touching the Trump voters. In fact, I think they're alienating even some of their base. I mean, this stuff is so radical that they're talking about out there that, you know, there's not even, we're not even talking safety net socialism. We're talking full on Marxian socialism, and that's where they are.
Absolutely. And there has been no greater example of this, no more clear-cut vision for socialism and sort of that first crack in the edifice of what the Dems hope would be a socialist nation than the issue of health care. So we're seeing sort of institutional government-operated health care as sort of their cause celeb. So really, for me, I think one of the most surprising incidents of the night was the take on between Julian Castro and Joe Biden. And when they debated one another specifically about Obamacare against the Medicare for All mandate. So let's listen to that clip right now.
They do not have to buy in.
You just said that. You just said that 2 minutes ago. You just said 2 minutes ago that they would have to buy in. You said they would have to buy in.
To buy in. If she qualifies for Medicaid,
are you forgetting what you said 2 minutes ago?
Be in for it.
Are you forgetting already what you said just 2 minutes ago? I mean, I can't believe that you said 2 minutes ago that they had to buy in, and now you're saying they don't have to buy. You're forgetting that.
I said anyone like your grandmother who has no money.
We need a healthcare system
that automatically enrolls
people regardless of whether they choose to opt in or not. If you lose your job, for instance, his healthcare plan would not automatically enroll you. You would have to opt in. My healthcare plan would. That's a big difference. I'm fulfilling the legacy of Barack Obama, and you're not.
I'll be surprised to him.
Wow. Well, there were repeated discussions about whether or not he was forgetting. Biden is, after all, 78. He is an older candidate for president. But these seem to be particularly vicious attacks against someone's individual fitness to be president. We know that's part of the discussion that we're allowed to have when these candidates take the stage. But do you find Biden himself to be a character that inspires leadership? And he's an individual who has, prior to this point, and will most likely continue to do so, painted himself as a moderate. Is he truly a moderate by definitions of Democratic standard?
Well, Joe Biden is no moderate. The only way he looks moderate is you've got some of the most radical left people on that stage with him, and then that makes Joe Biden look moderate. And then the rudeness and the disgusting display of Julian Castro amongst others, where they can't even allow each other to talk. This is what disgusts Americans when they see politics. And so Joe Biden is no moderate by any stretch. He's a lefty, but they're making him look moderate. Why are they making him look moderate? Because these people would fit in perfectly fine in the parties of the early 1900s, where you saw the socialism really getting its birth throughout Europe and America. So it's a real problem for them because they're a massive turnoff, quite frankly.
So this healthcare issue came up again, and after having gone sort of toe-to-toe with Julian Castro, Biden went on to defend Obamacare against the Medicare for All candidates and actually went so far as to overtly call it a bad idea. So let's listen to what he said in this clip.
She's for Bernie. Well, I'm for Barack. The senator on my left has not indicated how she pays for it. And the senator has, in fact, come forward and said how he's going to pay for it, but it gets him about halfway there.
Let's be clear about health care. We all owe a huge debt to President Obama, who fundamentally transformed health care in America and committed this country to health care for every human being. And now the question is, how best can we improve on it? And I believe the best way we can do that is we make sure that everybody gets covered by health care at the lowest possible cost.
Every study done shows that Medicare for All is the most cost-effective approach to providing health care to every man. Intend to eliminate all out-of-pocket expenses.
Bernie wrote the bill. I read the bill. And on page 8 of the bill, it says that we will no longer have private insurance as we know it. And that means that 149 million Americans will no longer be able to have their current insurance. I don't think that's a bold idea. I think it's a bad idea.
Well, I would have to agree there. And there are not a lot of things I would agree with by way of these Democratic presidential candidates. But eliminating privatized insurance seems fairly ridiculous. What are your perspectives on that?
No, that's exactly right. In fact, you've got 2 million people today who can't get insurance because of Obamacare. They just can't afford it. They have literally millions. And now they want to say you don't get your own insurance. I mean, this is been such a scam from the start. I mean, you've got, and the number I'm hearing is closer to 165, 170 million. But regardless of what it is, you've got half to two-thirds of Americans that would be without their private insurance. This, by plans from people who said, if you remember Obama saying, if you like your insurance, you can keep it. And the other thing, too, is the people conflate insurance with health care. It doesn't matter if you have health insurance if you can't afford the copay and the deductible. And these guys have not taken that on. And they're going to bring us to our knees financially and economically.
Congressman Andy Biggs from Arizona's 5th Congressional District, we are so happy to talk to you again. And congratulations one more on your selection as the next House Freedom Caucus chairman. You're listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday. Coming up next, New York City's council made a surprising move. They decided to repeal their own ban on sexual orientation and gender identity therapy. I'll talk with Roger Brooks, Alliance Defending Freedom senior counsel, about the about face. Coming up next on Washington Watch.
In states like New York, Virginia, and Vermont, radical legislation has been written legalizing abortion late in pregnancy, when babies can feel pain and are able to live outside the womb.
Happy birthday to you.
They've gone even further, repealing protections of infants born alive, allowing killing even after birth.
Happy
Congress has yet to protect the life of every newborn baby. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com to send Nancy Pelosi a newborn hat to show Congress every new life should be welcomed with warmth and love, not hate, not death. End birthday abortions. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com.
Happy birthday.
Paid for by Family Research Council.
Are you concerned with the state of our nation? Do you want to protect and promote religious freedom, the sanctity of life, free speech, and our children's educations? Today we see a growing threat against our values on the news, on our college campuses, in our elementary schools, at our public libraries, and in our courts. Every year in Washington, D.C., thousands of conservatives attend FRC Action's Values Voters Summit. From October 11th to the 13th, come to our nation's capital to mingle with and hear from key conservatives who are bringing real change to Washington, D.C., and learn how you can too. FRC President Tony Perkins will be there, along with Ali Stuckey, Bill Bennett, Dana Lash, Oliver North, and U.S. House and Senate leaders. The 2020 elections are right around the corner, so this is one weekend you won't want to miss. We provide free scholarships for students. Register online at valuesvotersummit.org or call 1-877-372-2808. That's 1-877-372-2808.
Are you looking for timely and honest coverage of the latest news? Do you find it difficult to sort out what is true and what is false from the media? Family Research Council is here to help. FRC President Tony Perkins' daily Washington Update email newsletter addresses the most important current events affecting religious freedom, the protection of life, marriage and family, and more, not only in Washington, but around the world. The Washington Update's daily articles cover a range of topics, from underreported stories about transgender activists' efforts to infiltrate our schools to updates on court cases fighting for religious freedom, parental rights, and the protection of life. Don't miss this critical, in-depth analysis of the day's most essential stories that are shaping our nation's future. Learn more and subscribe by visiting frc.org/update. Again, that's frc.org/update.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host today on this Friday afternoon, Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. As a reminder, go to our podcast website, tonyperkins.com. And for more information about the upcoming event we'll be holding Tuesday here, a lecture that we'll be discussing in our last block, go to frc.org/events. Well, New York City Council is planning to repeal the ban on so-called conversion therapy, known colloquially as sexual orientation and gender identity therapy, or SOCI. It passed this ban with much fanfare just 2 years ago, so it is now repealing its own ban. This is an unusual maneuver designed to sidestep a lawsuit from the Christian legal group Alliance Defending Freedom. The city council had banned counselors from offering help to people experiencing unwanted same-sex attraction or a struggle with their gender identity. Speaker Corey Johnson, the body's openly gay and HIV-positive leader, said yesterday that he plans to introduce legislation that would repeal New York City's prohibition on the practice. Joining me now is Roger Brooks, Alliance Defending Freedom's senior counsel, to help us break it down. Roger, welcome to Washington Watch.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So I think a lot of us who follow the issue of these therapeutic practices, and they have been discussed frequently in the news media. They are sort of increasing in the subconscious of the American people. I think some of us were surprised that the council would go so far as to repeal its own issued ban. Were you surprised by this particular tactic?
Well, I admit I was surprised by the timing, but I understand it. What this lawsuit is about is defending the right of New Yorkers, and obviously down the road, potentially every American, to pursue the lives and the orientation they want, to seek the counsel they want, to have private conversations uncensored by the government with the counsel of their choice, and illustrating the fact that this is kind of for everybody. This is a case where Alliance Defending Freedom was asked to represent, in this case, an Orthodox Jewish psychiatrist. And was very happy to do so. So we think there were fundamental constitutional issues at stake. We have, the case is still ongoing at the moment, a very strong case in front of the district judge, arguing that the law is fundamentally a violation of free speech as well as free exercise of religion. And the bottom line, I think, is that after they looked a little harder at the case, the city attorneys had to agree and agreed that this law was going to be found unconstitutional, and they decided they would rather not. They'd rather repeal the law than get that ruling on the books.
Well, in many ways, this is really a victory right out of the gate and before even having to step foot in a courtroom, which is encouraging for those of us who understand a little bit about the mechanisms of the law and what this law in particular would have done. Now, Corey Johnson, the speaker I previously mentioned, did describe this practice. Now, again, for our listeners, this is a voluntary therapeutic discussion service provided by these counselors. And in the case of the ADF client, an Orthodox Jew, Corey described it as barbaric and inhumane. What do you say to that charge?
Well, look, what goes on in this is a lot of PR bait and switch. There's movies out there, there's discussions out there that want to talk about electroshock therapy and restraining young people and what have you. But the law, is, in fact, has really nothing to do with that. It's just broad censorship. What Dr. Schwartz does, what many counselors, Christian and secular, do, and in this case Jewish, is ordinary psychotherapy. You come in with an issue that, you know, in your life that you want some difference in relationships and feelings and anger, and in this case, sexual attractions. And what he does is listen and ask questions and offer suggestions, and the hour's up and you get up and leave your chair and go out of his office, and you come back if you feel like he's helping you, and you don't come back if he's not helping you. Mm-hmm. There's nothing barbaric about that. It's simply free speech.
So this therapist, this Brooklyn therapist that ADF represents in this lawsuit against the city, challenged the law that was passed back in 2017 on the grounds that it violates the First Amendment. And it seems to me that the city council recognized that this was an extremely strong constitutional legal argument. Would you agree with that? Did they see the writing on the wall?
Well, they did. And you said earlier that it was without setting foot in the courtroom, and that's not quite right. In June, we had a lengthy oral argument on our motion in front of Judge Deary in the Eastern District of New York to get this law, it's called enjoined, to block enforcement while we continued the whole litigation. And I think that the way that argument went, now we haven't had a decision from the judge, I don't want to presume, but I think the argument and how that showed up in court definitely helped the city bring into focus to the city that this law was unconstitutional and was very likely to be found to be stricken.
Are you hopeful that this represents perhaps the beginning of a national trend? Because we understand that these are particular bans that have, in some cases, I know specifically in New Jersey, been passed specifically on consumer protection laws. In other words, this particular ban, this service does not provide what it says it will provide, and therefore we will issue a ban to make sure it cannot be provided again. Do you anticipate, even though there was a good outcome here in New York, do you anticipate more of these challenges, more of these laws and bans under different grounds in the future?
Well, the New York law was the first one in the nation that extended to conversations between a therapist and an adult. The other laws that you're mentioning have confined themselves to minors, though obviously 17-year-olds, 16-year-olds have free speech and First Amendment rights as well. Some of those laws are currently being challenged. I'm not representing anybody in those. So I think that this case is likely to slow down any motion elsewhere in the country to reach out and try to restrict adult counseling. And whether it is the beginning of something that will also roll back these restrictions on counseling of mature young people, we shall see.
Roger Brooks, who is senior counsel with Alliance Defending Freedom, has been my guest. You are listening to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, your host today, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Coming up next, Facebook labeled two videos from the pro-life group Live Action as false news and censored them. Both videos claim some facts that I'll talk to my next guest about, Dr. Ingrid Skop, an OBGYN who has serious knowledge on the issue. We'll be right back.
Did you know that Planned Parenthood was using taxpayer dollars to perform abortions? Recently, the Trump administration made changes to a healthcare policy called Title 10. The changes to this policy now eliminate the loopholes organizations like Planned Parenthood were using to receive taxpayer funding for abortions. Planned Parenthood was hiding behind terms like reproductive health care and services like cancer screenings and contraception distribution, while in reality, they were making money off of abortions. This shift in funding will benefit community health centers that provide needy families with family planning resources and health services, regardless of their ability to pay. It will also benefit pregnancy resource centers that provide care and free resources to women who may be experiencing an unplanned pregnancy. This policy decision is the right move to help and protect American lives. To learn more, visit frc.org/Title 10. That's frc.org/Title 10.
Hi, my name is Bailey. I am serving as an intern at Family Research Council, and it has been a life-changing experience. Interns join FRC's team of experts as they embark upon the mission of advancing faith, family, and freedom in public policy and the culture from a biblical worldview. The FRC internship is a 12 to 15 week program designed to educate and inspire university students who are passionate about public service and who believe that a biblical worldview is fundamental to the reformation of government and culture. As interns, we receive the opportunity to work alongside and be personally and professionally developed by FRC's team of experts. This paid internship offers free housing in the heart of DC, which allows us to be fully immersed in the fast-paced political climate and to build a community with other faithful conservatives in our nation's capital. For more information and to apply, visit frc.org/internships. That's frc.org/internships.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins. Well, four Republican senators sent a letter to Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg on the morning of September 11th, criticizing the platform's recent so-called fact check of the pro-life group Live Action with 3 million followers. Now, Facebook had claimed that two of Live Action's videos were inaccurate because they claimed that abortion is never medically necessary. Now, they labeled the videos false news and therefore shut them down. Now, a copy of this letter was signed by Senators Josh Hawley of Missouri, Ted Cruz of Texas, Kevin Cramer of North Dakota, and Mike Braun of Indiana. They condemned what they call Facebook's pattern of censorship and called on the platform giant to submit to an external audit. Then 7:24 p.m. on September 11th. So here we are the same day. Senator Hawley tweeted, "I'm pleased to say that Facebook has informed my office this evening that they will restore the Live Action and Lila Rose posts." So kind of a momentary victory of sorts. Joining me now to dig deeper is Dr. Ingrid Skop, a practicing OBGYN for 22 years. She authored and provided video for FRC's top 10 myths about abortion. To read her answers and watch the video in detail, go to frc.org/myths. Dr. Skop, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Thank you so much for having me, Sarah.
Okay, first, I have got to tell our listeners that Facebook's fact checkers who claim that abortion could be medically necessary were themselves affiliated with the abortion industry. Daniel Grossman, who's on the board of NARAL, Pro-Choice America Foundation, and Robin Schickler, who is a fellow with Physicians for Reproductive Health. So this is a bit like two foxes guarding the hen house, isn't it?
That's how it usually is with abortion. Most of the studies that seem to show how safe it is are performed by the abortion providers. So we've kind of always allowed them to write the narrative.
Okay, so let's put this into some perspective. Of the abortions committed in the U.S. each year, only 1 to 3% are for what we would call hard cases, okay? These are difficult cases of rape, incest, fetal anomalies, danger to the mother's lives. So tell us about a very large study which confirmed the elective nature of most late-term abortions.
Yeah, the study, interestingly, was done by the abortion providers, and they did not even list these hard cases because apparently they are so few. So they confirmed for us that women have late abortions for almost exactly the same reason that they have early abortions. And I would say the number one reason is lack of partner support. For many women, maybe they've even carried the pregnancy and have desired the pregnancy. And when the relationship blows up later in pregnancy, those are the women that then sometimes go to seek abortions. A second reason that they reported was indecision. So again, you can see this kind of probably back and forth. If she's so indecisive that she can't have an abortion early, who knows whether the day after she has the abortion, she's going to change her mind again. And what are the mental health repercussions of that? I think that a lot of these late abortions are probably also the result of coercion. These are women who, and maybe young teenagers, who they themselves want to continue the pregnancy, and they keep it a secret from their parents or from their boyfriend. And then when it's no longer able to be kept a secret, then these women are presenting for late abortions. And so, you know, that's a question that often doesn't get studied. But even reading between the lines on Guttmacher Institute's information, I think it's clear that there is some coercion that occurs.
Okay, so what can an OBGYN do later in the pregnancy when a woman who is sick and pregnant to save the baby and save the woman's life? Because if you listen to the NARAL fact checkers, there is a real disparity of viewpoint here, but there are options, aren't there? Can you talk about some of those?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, any OBGYN can, if the pregnancy poses a risk to the mother's life, and it doesn't happen often, but it can on occasion be the case. These tend to be situations like severe hypertension, HELLP syndrome, eclampsia, where the woman really truly is at risk, or an infection in the uterus where her body, she needs to empty the uterus to clear the infection. Any OBGYN knows how to separate a baby from his mother. So that's not an abortion. That's a medically indicated separation. And sometimes they occur early, but almost always they occur after viability. Viability right now is about 22 weeks. That's only halfway through a pregnancy. So it's very rare that the baby that there can't be an attempt to save the baby's life. And we can do this by induced labor. We can do this by cesarean section. The intent of an abortion is to kill the baby. That's the definition of abortion. So these are not abortions. These are premature separations. If a woman is truly ill and I send her out of a hospital to an abortionist clinic, then I'm sending her to a lower level of care, and her life may be even more in danger because she's left the hospital that can care for her.
Dr. Ingrid Skop, OBGYN, and author of the Top 10 Abortion Myths, available at frc.org/myths, is our guest today. Next up, I'll talk to Max Eden, co-author of Why Meadow Died, who will talk about policies in education that endanger America's students. We'll be right back.
We live in a time of great political division, and this division only intensifies during campaign season. The toxic tone in politics can be discouraging, which makes it a very real temptation for many Christians to wipe their hands of politics altogether. After all, if God is sovereign and controls the heart of the king, as Proverbs says, do we really need to get involved in the messy world of politics? Because political engagement can be divisive, shouldn't Christians abandon politics and direct their energies toward more spiritual pursuits? Christians are called to submit every area of their life to God, which includes how they engage in politics. But they are called to engage biblically. This requires Christians to be prepared to follow their political theology to its logical end and vote for candidates and parties that support clear biblical values. For more information on the Christians' call to engage in politics, visit frc.org/engage. That's frc.org /engage.
Radical abortion laws in New York, Illinois, and Vermont are challenging the sanctity of life. These laws have lifted the few existing restrictions on abortion in the name of family planning and mental health of pregnant mothers. Americans need to take a stand and defend the rights of the unborn. Family Research Council is sending Congress 90,000 baby hats as a reminder that babies should be welcomed with love and warmth, not potential danger. Supporters have already funded over 45,000 hats. We are over halfway there. Join Americans across the nation and donate $9 to send a powerful reminder that young lives need to be cherished. When you take action, we'll send you an end birthday abortion certificate that will remind you to pray for born alive babies who are facing the danger of being killed outside the womb. Visit endbirthdayabortion.com for more information. That's endbirthdayabortion.com.
Hello, this is Tony Perkins, President of the Family Research Council here in Washington, D.C., and I would like to invite you to join my wife, LaWanna, and I, along with Lieutenant General Jerry Boykin and former Congresswoman Michelle Bachmann, for FRC's Israel Tour, June the 2nd through the 12th, 2020. Whether you're sailing on the Sea of Galilee, standing in the ruins of Capernaum, or journeying up to Jerusalem, Israel is unlike any other place on earth. You'll relive the final earthly days of Jesus as you pray in the Garden of Gethsemane. You look upon Golgotha and stand in the Garden Tomb. The reality of his story will come alive in a transformative way. This one-of-a-kind tour will not only allow you to explore the land of the Bible and the roots of our Christian faith, you'll also hear firsthand from some of Israel's political, defense, and religious leaders. Join us June the 2nd through June the 12th for this life-changing experience. For more information, visit TonyPerkins.com or call 844-872-5155.
Welcome back to Washington Watch. I'm your host, Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins today on this Friday afternoon edition. As a reminder, go to TonyPerkins.com. And for this segment, you're also going to want to go to FRC.org/events. The Parkland, Florida shooting on February 14th, 2018 was the most avoidable mass murder in American history. It claimed the lives of 17 students and staff, injured 17 others, and the policies that made it inevitable are now being forced into public schools across America. But there are two people who have written a book that we are going to talk about today, and we will hear a lecture on Tuesday that you are absolutely going to want to read if you have children in school. Hunter Pollack, whose sister Meadow was murdered at MSD, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School that day, said that the media obsessed for months about the type of rifle the killer used. It was all clickbait and politics, not answers or justice. My dad teamed up with Max Eden, one of America's leading education experts, to launch his own investigation. That is the foreword to Why Meadow Died, the People and Policies That Created the Parkland Shooter and Endanger America's Students. The book is now available on Amazon. So go to Amazon today, bring it up. It is number one right now on Amazon in this political category. But let's bump it up, because your hearing this story will shock you. Joining me now is Max Eden, the co-author of this compelling new book. He's a senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute and a graduate of Yale University. Max, welcome back to Washington Watch.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Sarah.
Okay, so tell us a little bit about how you came to be the author of this book with Andy Pollack, because really the origin story here, two different people coming from different perspectives, one who had lost a child in this shooting, is really kind of a story in and of itself.
Yeah, so I work at a think tank in Washington, D.C. I study education policy for a living. And after the shooting, you know, one group of students came forward. They got a lot of attention. They were calling for gun control. Another group of students came forward. They got less attention. They were saying, The student threatened to kill us. The student threatened to rape us. We all knew that he was going to shoot up the school. We knew before it was over that it was him. We saw something. We said something, but they did nothing. And so from a distance, I look at this and I have a kind of policy hat on. I think, huh, Broward County, Florida, where this is located, was the national leader in this effort to fight the so-called school-to-prison pipeline by aggressively lowering suspensions, expulsions, and arrests. I wonder if the pressure to get these numbers down had something to do with how it happened. So I wrote an article. I went down a couple months later to try to answer the question myself, and Andy heard that there was somebody from D.C. who was in town looking for answers, and he wanted every answer he could find. He wanted every lead he could find. So he found a way to get my number. I didn't contact him, called me over to his house. I explained to him what I was doing, and he texted me afterwards and said, thank you so much, Max. You're going to be such a tremendous asset helping me find justice for my daughter's murder.
And the rest, as they say, is history, because the two of you have co-authored this book together. Now, this was the result and really the follow-up to so many individuals, including a student journalist, including Andy Pollack himself, asking questions and getting stonewalled at every turn. And central to this discussion is something called the Promise Program. What did this have to do with it?
So everything and very little at the same time, in a way, right? I mean, when we were asking these questions about whether or not these leniency policies played a role, Superintendent Robert Runcie said, that's fake news. He told the grieving parents who were asking for answers, that's fake news, because he had never been referred to the Promise Program while in high school. So, you know, most reporters took that as a full denial. Obviously, those last three words were there for a reason. As we kept on pressing, we realized, in fact, he was referred to the Promise Program while in middle school. The Promise Program is a diversionary program that gives students three free misdemeanors every year and resets, and is part and parcel of this broader kind of lawless leniency that took reign over Broward County, where they literally trained principals to refuse to cooperate with law enforcement told school resource officers to look the other way on felonies. So the superintendent wanted to play clever by saying it wasn't the Promise Program itself, but that was a misleading half-truth. But the more important truth behind it was that this effort to fight the so-called school-to-prison pipeline created a climate in Broward that was literally lawless.
And literally, when we say that it was lawless, truly, this is an individual, and I believe the last time we spoke, you told me that he had had 102 notations in his record for his activity, his abuse, his violence, the way he acted in school. This is a kid, you told me, had to be strapped down on his way to school because he was so violent and disruptive on the school bus. So all of this stems from what you've referred to as the school to prison pipeline. But the bigger idea behind this is that teachers are racist. They discipline students disparately based on their race, and they will discipline more severely a minority child or more severely a disabled child as opposed to a white, neurotypical child. Now, not giving these teachers the capability to maintain order and appropriate conduct within their classes, reiterating this idea that the teachers cannot be trusted, that they must not cooperate with law enforcement. You've left this essentially to a Wild West atmosphere. And you're leaving here kids in the classroom who are not only physically disruptive, not only physically violent, and not only disrespectful, disobedient, but you've also disrupted the education of the other kids in the classroom. And as a mother of three in public school, I think to myself, this would be extremely problematic, not only from a safety perspective, but also from the standpoint that your child has interfered with the education of my child. So what are the answers to this repeated social justice narrative that teachers are racist, the system is racist, it's institutional racism, we can't trust teachers to take care of it. How do we respond to that?
I really think that this isn't a 50-50 issue. I'd like to think this isn't a left-right issue. I'd like to think this is a kind of 99 to 1% issue where it just so happens that the 1% are the ones who set the policy. I think that if parents go to their teachers and ask them questions, hey, is there some student in my child's classroom who everybody knows shouldn't be there? Hey, is your principal just sweeping things under the rug? Hey, have you ever been threatened or assaulted or seen another student bullied or hit with no consequence whatsoever because you think that the principal is trying to cover things up to look good, to comply with these politically correct ideas? If the teachers say yes to you, you as a parent have the power to try to make a change. You can go to your school board member. You can go to your principal. You know, I think when after Marjorie Stoneman Douglas happened, the instinct certainly from CNN and the media and then the Democratic Party was to point a finger at politicians who, quote unquote, weren't doing enough. But what Andy and I learned and what every parent needs to know is that politicians can only do so much. They can't actually control what goes on in your kid's school. Only an involved parent who asks questions and takes steps towards people who have control of what's going on in your kid's classrooms can actually make any difference whatsoever.
So Nick Cruz did not have, he was not a minority. He did have a disability, but bringing this up to current speed, the U.S. Commission on Civil Rights just came out with a report this week. So again, and you and I have talked about this offline, your book could not have been more perfectly timed. This has come right back into the public consciousness, into the collective American narrative, because now we're forced with this spate, this rash of school shootings, to really look deeper, not just at the guns, but in what is perpetuating a violence in which this type of behavior succeeds. So isn't it a problem that, for example, students with disabilities are disproportionately disciplined? Is there an addressing of this in the book? And isn't it a problem if the Commission on Civil Rights says that these kids with disabilities have a tendency to be disciplined more often? How do we answer that?
Yeah, the answer is not in the slightest. And even the people who wrote that report knew that it was false. They actually walked back their central claim when the Washington Post asked them about it. It's how dishonest the U.S. Commission of Civil Rights is. It gets back to this deeper issue, which is just an inability for progressive bureaucrats to recognize the existence of evil, the existence of sin, right? They take a student like the Parkland shooter, who is extremely emotionally and behaviorally disturbed, who wants to kill, who's made it clear that he wants to kill from a young age, and they label him special, and they treat him like he was a student with dyslexia or a student who is deaf or a student who has a slight learning impairment. And the idea is to include them at all costs. You know, students with disabilities are not disciplined more frequently. The only subgroup is students with this emotional and behavioral disturbance. So it's a combination of an inability of progressive bureaucrats to recognize, you know, the existence of evil and sin, and this kind of ideological derangement that can't separate the difference between students who have evil within them and students who have a hard time learning. I think we just need to say that it is, to coin a term, just a fake idea, fake news, and ask and trust teachers to recognize and take action on what they see right in front of them.
Well, and it gives teachers control over their own environments, and kids learn best in an environment in which they can all flourish. And it can't possibly be that all the students flourish when there is a student who is disruptive, violent, and aggressive. Now, you and I, we understand that there were a ton of bureaucrats behind the scenes and in front of the scenes who were really making this perfect storm that took the disciplinary options out of the hands of the actual educators. But what do you think about the people who put the blame on the National Rifle Association? Because everyone automatically goes right to the handguns.
You know, Cliff, at first I was more neutral on it, Sarah. At first I was like, okay, well, you know, they have their idea and they're pushing it. But But the more I think about it, the people in Broward County who were pushing this with them, were organizing and coordinating messaging, they knew what went wrong. The sheriff knew what his deputies did wrong. The superintendent knew what his school did wrong. It's hard to look at a mass murder that instantly becomes an occasion for a political movement, not even before the facts are known, before the bodies are taken out of the school, and not just feel some kind of profound disgust at this political instinct that plays out in front of us before we actually take a step back and look at the facts. If the facts were that the NRA had some policy connection to it, Andy would have been with those March for Our Lives kids. But, you know, they can say background checks all they want. The fact is that their policies prevent juveniles from ever getting backgrounds. Background checks are a moot point if we refuse to arrest or commit students who say repeatedly that they want to kill.
Mm. It provides us really with a roadmap for what works and what doesn't work. And parents across the country really need to be caring about what disciplinary policies are in place. And I am, after having read your book, the parent that sat down when my kids started school and pored over our county's disciplinary procedures handbook for tier 1, 2, and 3 offenses and wanted to see precisely by the letter of the law what teachers and administrators were and were not allowed to do. And blessedly, our school district does not have a policy like this. But I will say again, the timing, unbelievably perfect on this book, because California's Governor Newsom just signed into law yesterday what was Senate Bill 419, a bill that limits California schools' capability to suspend students for disrupting school activities, willfully defying valid authority of school personnel. It's almost precisely Florida 2.0. And there is already blowback from organizations who recognize that this is not only dangerous, but it is the repetition of a trend that could really take students' lives. So one more minute is left in this discussion here. What do you want parents to know? Because I know many parents listen to the show. What's your takeaway for them in American education?
Yeah, I mean, you know, one takeaway, to be frank, Sarah, is to get the book. You know, my co-author Andrew says every interview he has that he has to live for the rest of his life with the guilt of having no idea what was going on at his daughter's school, of having no idea that there was a kid so dangerous that they had to frisk him every day for a weapon. They knew wanted to kill students, but that didn't even have much of a record, a basic discipline record in high school. You know, he never thought to ask his daughter. He never thought to ask his daughter's teachers. He never thought to try to read the policies. And his thing is he wants to be the last father who can honestly say, I had no idea what was going on in my child's school.
Buy the book, Why Meadow Died, by Max Eden and Andrew Pollack. It is available now on Amazon, and go to frc.org/events. We will have them here on Tuesday for a lecture at noon. You can stream it online. I've been Sarah Perry, sitting in for Tony Perkins on this Friday edition of Washington Watch. Have a great weekend, and we'll see you next time.
Washington Watch with Tony Perkins is powered by the Family Research Council and is entirely listener-supported. For more information on anything you've heard today, or to find out how you can partner with us in our ongoing efforts to promote faith, family, and freedom, visit TonyPerkins.com. Also, to leave a comment about Washington Watch, call our watch line at 1-866-372-7234. That's 1-866-372-7234.